This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So for the second month of the Radio West Book Club, we are reading Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine. Now, Bradbury, of course, is one of the best-known science fiction writers of the 20th century. He wrote Fahrenheit 451, The Martian Chronicles. Dandelion Wine, though, is different from his other works. This is a nostalgic look at one boy's summer in 1928. It's full of the sights and sounds and tastes of childhood in a small Midwestern town. And because it's Bradbury, the stories in the book are often laced with this darkness and a melancholy that keeps it from getting too saccharine. Along with the golden days, there are strange encounters, there's heartache, even a few murders. We met recently as a group to talk about Dandelion Wine. Leading the conversation was Radio West executive producer Christy Miners, and she was joined by Jonathan Eller. He's director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. Dr. Eller is the author of the book Becoming Ray Bradbury and the forthcoming Bradbury Beyond Apollo, which is going to be published next month. And speaking of next month, Dr. Eller began the conversation by telling us that this year, this August, in fact, marks the 100th anniversary of Ray Bradbury's birth.
That is a remarkable century when you look back on it. Here's a guy born in the Midwest in 1920, grows up in the Great Depression, could never go to college a day in his life, and yet he's probably the best-known writer of our time, one of the best-known writers of our time. Four generations of readers grow up and read him because their parents introduce them, or their older siblings, as happened with you, Christy, will introduce them to him. And without that college degree, he won a Pulitzer for Lifetime Achievement, National Book Award Medal for Lifetime Achievement, National Medal of Arts from President Bush, and many foreign decorations as well. A remarkable life that we're celebrating now in 2020, but it started out, you know, in rough times. His dad, you know, they were just a working class family there in Waukegan, Illinois in 1920, lived in a little frame house they rented from his grandfather who lived next door. And he had this idyllic childhood that you're really reading, right, recreated in Dandelion Wine. Right behind his neighborhood was the ravine in Waukegan, which is noted as one of the great geological features of its kind in the Midwest. It can't touch anything you all have in Utah, but in the Midwest, it's a wonderful thing, and it's a scary thing, and it's also a fun place to play as long as you're playing in the daylight. But they lived there for off and on until 1934, but the high years of the Depression, his dad lost his job in 32. They moved once. He lost his job again in 34, and they went all the way west. By that time, only two of the four children were alive. Two of them had died of the great influenza, one in the 1918-1919 epidemic, the twin of his surviving older brother, and then his baby sister in 1927 also died of influenza. And his mom almost died before he was born. So they'd seen a lot of tough living. When they got to LA, his dad really never had a real steady job until he started working for the Power and Light Company out there. But Bradbury was a voracious reader, didn't really do well in a classroom environment. He watched every movie he could ever see. He read all the books that his creative writing teachers got him to read. And then later when he was older in high school and beyond high school, his mentors would have him read, and he educated himself. Public libraries, from the old Carnegie Library back home in Waukegan, onto the Los Angeles Public Library, the grand building there that burned down in 1986. You might have read the new book last year by Susan Orlean, I think, called The Library, which is about the burning of that library. And she talks about Fahrenheit 451 in that very book. So, you know, these are the books of his that remain from a very early part in his life. Once he learned not to imitate, once he learned that what he knew from experience is what you should write about, then he started to really build stories that were unforgettable. Not every story. He published 450 stories and about 32, you know, books, novels, story collections, and essay collections. But the best of those stories always had the metaphors you're talking about, the rich metaphor-rich poetic prose, He was a prose poet. Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, called him a prose poet when he got to know him a little bit in the early 1950s. So Bradbury then writes about what it's like to have the hopes and fears and the loves and hates and the passions and the terrors of a child, and how then that grows and transforms and makes us the adults we are. And he'd sometimes couch these into the stories of the challenges of going to outer space. And over a period of about the first 20 years of his career, the 40s and 50s, he wrote the seven or eight books that are classics today. They will never go out of print. Martian Chronicles, Illustrated Man, The Golden Apples of the Sun, Fahrenheit 451, which still sells over 200,000 copies a year. And then The October Country, his scary stories from the 40s, and then Dandelion Wine in 1957, which is a different kind of book that he had been really trying to write for almost 10 years at that point. He wanted to go back and look at that little boy who was growing up in Waukegan and all the people he knew, the boys and the girls, the grown-ups that he didn't really understand, and that life. And he picks that one summer of 1928 to unfold it for you in Dandelion Wine.
Out of curiosity, who were some of his literary influences? Who was he reading? What was informing what he was writing? He was writing about what he knew, but also what were his literary influences?
Well, he read a lot of genre literature, you know, and of course, people think of him as a genre literature in supernatural stories, in science fiction, in fantasy, even in detective fiction. But he really didn't follow the rules of genre, and he helped raise a lot of those genres into the mainstream. But he started out early on reading 19th century writers, Edgar Allan Poe. He fell in love with Edgar Rice Burroughs, primarily the John Carter of Mars books, those 10 volumes about an Earthman who ends up being transported to the sort of primitive, high-tech warrior world of Mars. And that was a big influence on him, because even in the 20s and 30s, he's reading Percival Lowell, he's reading about canals on Mars. And remember, he's in his 30s, he's almost 40, before in the early 60s, we finally realize and can prove that Mars doesn't have a viable atmosphere for our kind of life. But he was writing in the 40s and 50s under the influence of these sort of neo-romantic space opera writers, but also great writers who wrote about the world around them. He was a big fan of John Steinbeck. He loved books like The Grapes of Wrath. He loved books like some of Hemingway's books. He loved Huxley's essays. He loved Brave New World, because Brave New World did something that he would do later in Fahrenheit. Brave New World and Fahrenheit 451 asked that important question we still ask today: who watches the people who run our science? Who watches the watchers? So he absorbed all this from mainstream writers, from genre writers, and he started to then stop imitating them. He even imitated Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. He imitated, we were talking earlier, P.G. Woodhouse, you know, Jeeves and Wooster kind of stuff. He'd do mysteries around them, characters like them. But when he realized that what he had to write about was the things he knew from experience, that's when his writing took off. And really, by the late 40s, his magazine articles, or his stories, are now in the big time magazines and not just the pulps. And in 1950, when the Martian Chronicles comes out with Doubleday, he was in. His books were going everywhere. They end up in the libraries. Children still read them. One time he was here visiting and was talking in a university lecture series, and the audience in this huge auditorium was all moms and dads with their children, bringing them to introduce Ray Bradbury's world to them. And this goes on generation after generation.
And a lot of those stories he was having published later ended up in Dandelion Wine, right? Like, one of the things we've been talking about on our Facebook group is how did he order these? How did, you know, what was the span that he was writing these? How did they go from being short stories to, painfully, you said, ended up putting them together in a novel?
Yeah, it was very painful for him. Dandelion Wine proved to be the biggest writer's block of his career. This was a guy who would sit there every day and he'd wake up and he'd have the hidden theater of the mind, he would call it. He'd wake up and he'd let the ideas, while he was still quiet, come up, whatever welled up out of his subconscious, he'd word associate and then try to write a story. And that worked for him a lot of the time. But he was like Mark Twain. He was like Edgar Allan Poe. He could not really write long, sustained fiction. He was a natural short story writer. So to pull a book-size project together was always hard for him to do. The Martian Chronicles were just really 17 stories about going to Mars, which is really like Earth. They're doing to Mars what that we've done to our planet. And it was not really a novel, it was a chronicle, right? And when he gets ready to pull all these stories about his hometown together, has the same problem doing it, but ultimately he succeeds better. He takes stories he started writing in about 1945, 46. He planned a book that would be kind of a defiant book. He thought, you know, children are completely different creatures than adults. It's like a chrysalis, a pupa, a caterpillar, and a butterfly, you know? And grown-ups don't understand children because they're alien creatures, and vice versa. Children don't trust grown-ups. They don't want to eat the food that we make them eat. They don't want to play the way that we want them to play. And they certainly, the boys don't want to have anything to do with girls until they're about 12 or 13 years old, and probably vice versa as well. So it was supposed to be sort of a confrontational coming-of-age book, but the stories didn't write that book for him. The stories weren't going to write that kind of book. It just didn't come together. He had all these stories pulled out, but he ends up taking the best ones, and in the mid-50s, he crafts a smaller book, and that's what you have, Dandelion Wine, okay? The big book took him another 50 years to write, and it's called Farewell Summer, okay? But these are the rest of the stories. And he pulled out all the ones that go into Dandelion Wine. Here's an old cover from the early 70s, late 60s. And of course, that's the green wine for dreaming bottle, isn't it? And so in 45, he writes The Night as a one-off. But isn't that a wonderful story? Because we have a story there where you realize that things can happen to the people around you and your parents can't always stop it. And people can die, okay? Beautiful little story he weaves in there into Dandelion Wine. He's written a lot of stories about the spontaneity of waking up, the one called Illumination, which is the I'm Alive story. They're not titled in the book, but they were all titled when they were published individually. And he published most every one of these, actually every one of them, except for three that got into the Dandelion Wine as first publication, like The Tarot Witch. I don't know why he couldn't sell The Tarot Witch. It's a beautiful little story. You know, the little lady who has the fortune cards, the little machine. Mm-hmm. It sort of was an inspiration for the movie Big, I guess. You remember the old Tom Hanks movie, you know, where the fortune teller makes the boy small. Ray Bradbury's just in the culture. People didn't rip him off, but people were inspired by him, you know. So you have all the stories. I'm just sort of looking at one of my little references here. You know, he wrote about Colonel Freely as a time machine. He wrote about, one of the most suspenseful stories he ever wrote is titled The Whole Town Sleeping. And it's the story of Lavinia Nibs, right? Mm-hmm. Probably the most exciting, suspenseful story in the whole book. It's a terrifying story, especially that ending. It had the Bradbury twist that writers and readers often liked about him. He wrote about strange things like The Lonely One. And then you see how she almost loses her life. Well, of course, in the original story, well, I don't want to spoil it. But remember, all these stories had lives, and they were all a little bit different originally. They were all a little bit different. And what he does, once he realizes that this giant story book with like 50 stories in it wasn't going to work like that, he pulled out these, I don't know, there's probably about 20 here, 25. That he pulls out and he bridges them together in 1955, 56, And he makes a book that's more like Huck Finn. He makes a book that's more like Mark Twain writing Life on the Mississippi, something that's closer to a novel. It's sort of, as his editor said, a half cousin to a novel. He weaves this tapestry. And even one of the bridges he puts in is about beating the rugs, right, to clean the rugs, sort of the tapestries and the rugs outside. And little by little, he frames it up as the summer of 1928. You wake up the town from the cupola in your grandparents' house bedroom. Actually, that was his great-grandparents' house, and it was torn down by then. But that's okay. This is Ray Bradbury's world of fantasy, right? He can do anything he wants to with the things that come up out of his subconscious mind and come back to him. And he weaves this summer, right, where everybody, I don't know, Christy, do we want to get into kind of the structure of the novel at this point?
Yeah, I think it's worth talking a little bit about that. You know, a lot of this is fantasy and, you know, magical realism and whatnot, but a lot of this also, he was pulling truly from his own background. These are real people, real names, based entirely on the setting that he grew up in, and then he took that and fantasized it in many ways.
That's absolutely true. And you just reminded me, that's a great trigger for me, because in the second book of the biography, I quoted him from the 60s, and he says, a writer cannot possibly speak futures, and of course that's what he's known for, right, by then, speaking about our futures. A writer cannot possibly speak futures unless that writer has a strong sense of the past. And that's what we have here. He takes his whole past to this town with him. And he sits down, when people ask him how he wrote it, he said, so in writing Dandelion Wine, I was doing more of the time traveling, fueled by nostalgia, I was picking up and putting down objects which represented noon and midnight, good and evil, the vast cry of terror, or the easeful sigh of relaxation on a summer evening early. Everything from Lavinia Nibs, right, Nibs, all the way to the old people sitting on the porch in the porch swing, right, just talking. Or mowing the lawns of summer.
And right. John Huff was actually a real person, you said?
Absolutely. John Huff, right in 1932, his dad drove them all the way across country in a 1926 Buick, the two surviving children and mama, and they came with nothing, and they got as far as Tucson, Arizona on the dirt roads and tried to make a go of it, and they couldn't do it. But while he was in school there in the seventh grade, he met John Huff, who was just this wonderful, go-out, spontaneous kind of natural-born leader. They had tons of fun. You know, they loved each other like brothers. They were just very close. And then within 9 months, Ray Bradbury's dad takes him all the way back to Waukegan again to try and get another job. But he never forgot John Huff. And you see that memory moved from Waukegan to Tucson, or I'm sorry, moved from Tucson to Waukegan in the story, and it's not Ray Bradbury leaving Tucson, it's John Huff moving away from Waukegan, see, is how he does it. And then many years later, in the late 1970s, Ray got a phone call from John Huff, out of the blue. He had no idea where he was. He was a dean at University of Arizona in Tucson. He had come back. Ray would always pronounce Tucson as Tucson. John Huff had gone to college and come back and taught there at the University of Arizona. And in the late 70s, he writes to Ray and he says, my son just came home from high school and said, Dad, did you ever know some writer named Ray Bradbury? And John Huff said, well, yes, I did. We were friends when we were boys in the early 1930s. And his son said, well, he put you in his book, Dandelion Wine, and we're reading it in school right now. And so John Huff was just amazed, and he got in touch with Ray Bradbury, and then they were friends again for the rest of their lives.
I love that story. Talk about a good way to get in touch with somebody. Put them in your story. Become a best-selling author.
Indeed, and so many people will remember the time that they read a Ray Bradbury story, and it's almost like characters step out of his books and into their own lives too. We know all these people. They're universal kinds of people. They have the same needs and desires and anxieties that we do. And in his best work, that's what's rememberable.
You brought up the Tarot Witch and some of these other Colonel Freely. And it reminded me, there's a recurring theme throughout the whole book of machines.
Yes.
We've got the happiness machine. We've got the green machine, the future, or the time traveling machine.
Yes, yes.
Let's see, what are some of the others? I'm trying to remember. Anybody remember what are some of the other machines?
Don't forget our two older ladies. What do they have?
They're the green machine, right?
Yes.
The green machine. I love it. They think they kill somebody with it. But I'm wondering, what was Bradbury getting at with these? I mean, there's the trolley, which becomes defunct. Mm-hmm. But machines to some degree or another appear in many of the stories throughout the book. And what do you guys think that he's getting at? If you want to start this off, Dr. Eller, what's he getting at with these machines that he's bringing up at this time?
Well, I think that as readers, we definitely see a pattern there. Okay. We've got wake up. June 1928, wake up town, okay? Wake up the town, and it starts going, and he's got all these machines, literally the time machines like Colonel Freely, Leo Hoffman is building the happiness machine that you're talking about there. And as a matter of fact, here's a picture in an edition we did years ago. Here's the Saturday Evening Post picture of Leo Hoffman, and he's built this thing like a crazy telephone booth, and his poor wife is in there trying to understand what he's trying to do. Because she knows what the happiness machine really is, right? It's, well, I don't know. Maybe some of you have an idea what the happiness machine is, and you may want to pop up and tell us or ask on the chat at some point. But sure, these machines are there for him, but then something happens. There's a structure, there's a sequence of a sort of crisis moment for especially the 12-year-old Doug, but even the 10-year-old Tom. Anybody?
We talked a little bit about the machines. Anybody else have any comments about what he was getting at with these? I saw him, so many of these stories are so seeped in nostalgia, but a lot of the things that he's being nostalgic for are dying. And I saw machines as, in a way, they're sort of taking away, but the machines he loves are also going away. There seems to be some tension there with what he's doing.
Any of you think back to when you're 12 years old? Did the world just seem to become a more complicated place about that time in your life?
It seems that way. And this is also, I think, one of the things that Bradbury is doing here. There's so much, along with that nostalgia, there's a lot of darkness in these stories. And that becomes infused even with these machines and other things. It's not all, you know, childhood is not all just happiness and easy. There's a lot of pain and difficulty here too, especially for Douglas, as he has some pretty major realizations that not only is he alive, but he can die. And not only him, but other people as well.
And Ray Bradbury was always fascinated by that almost undefinable intersection of life and death. And he saw the ravine as being the seat of all of those mysteries. That's where the lonely one strangles people, right? Boys don't want to be down there at night. He and his brother Skip, who was 4 years older, were coming back from the movie theater one time. They'd seen a Lon Chaney film in 1927. And Skip runs on ahead. And when they get to the bridge at the bottom of the ravine and come up the other side, Skip, who was a big athletic kid, jumps out and just scares Ray. He probably had to burn his underwear when he got home that night. But in any event, there was all of that that sense, that ability to see that the town had its young people and its middle-aged people and its older people. And there were things that as you grew older, you got privileges, you became more mature. But there's a price, and the price is that you also know not just the great joys of the world, but the suffering as well. This is that moment where he begins to realize that things can die, and things aren't always there forever. Like all the machines, you take them off, they all go, right?
Right. Every one of them. The Tarot Witch is the most dramatic.
Yeah. Yeah, literally, Mr. Dark, who he's just the alcoholic guy there who runs the little penny arcade there. And there really was an arcade like that, by the way. It was just down If you cross the ravine from his neighborhood, going into downtown to the Carnegie Library, that's where the real arcade was. And there was a Taro witch there, indeed. But he creates this Mr. Dark, who will later, he will use that name again as the great evil carnival owner in Something Wicked This Way Comes. Mm-hmm. That's the other book that punctuates this wonderful 12-year period from 1950 with the Martian Chronicles to Something Wicked This Way Comes. So he talks about dark things. Now, before I forget, I should probably, without being a spoiler here, you know, what happens to Lavinia Nebs explores a little bit of those dark corners. Even this beautiful story called The Swan, where the reporter is having ice cream with the one of the oldest ladies in the town, right? And they realize that if their ages were the same, they would have naturally fallen in love, right? And she tells him how to bear it, right? That someday when he's reborn again and he meets a beautiful young woman who also loves to eat the lime vanilla ice at the ice cream shop, it'll be her. So he's trying to, you know, show us all these fantasies we think about. What's life about? How do we, I mean, what does it all mean? Ray didn't like beginnings and endings. He never accepted really the Big Bang Theory. He was kind of a steady state universe kind of guy. Like great grandma, when she dies here, what does she do? She just explains to him, honey, I'm just going back to the big dream that I came out of all those years ago. I'm just going back to it, right? So he's exploring all that. And the Lavinia Nebs story has a sequel that he could not put in Dandelion Wine because it's an alternate ending and it carries on as a very dark sequel. So I'm just sort of piquing your interest there. That's, I believe, in a Bradbury collection from the 70s called Long After Midnight. Good title for a Bradbury book, isn't it? So yes, he's really probing the insights you get as you grow older and the price you pay sometimes for those insights because you realize the relative shortness of life.
Yeah.
To the point about machines, I was just thinking about a project I worked on a few years ago for a different public radio station I used to work for, where I think we actually called it Breaking the News. And we would go and, with the parents' permission, of course, set down a family who had sort of agreed to be part of this project and talk to their kids who were usually 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. And we brought a climate scientist with us and we explained climate change in very stark, very real, very science-based terms to them. And there was one little boy who was probably 12 years old who immediately got some markers out and started drawing a machine to fix it. He was like, don't worry, I'm on it. We will come up with something. And I just, at that moment, it brought me back to that age where it did feel like you could invent anything, right? You could invent a machine to solve any problem you could imagine. If we could imagine the problem, we could imagine a machine that would be designed to fix it. And I think sort of the way so many of us are still enamored with technology as a way to solve problems. But as we know, and as Bradbury knew and much of his other work, if we can build a machine, we don't always, as you're saying, watch the watchers or watch the ethics of the things we build or the creations we make. And it just made me think back to that moment with that little boy who was convinced that any machine could be built to fix any problem and how pervasive that is in science fiction and how good science fiction shows not usually the case.
And go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was just going to say, you think about the time too that Bradbury's coming out of, you know, the 20s, the 30s. This is the futurist time. I mean, we have movies like Metropolis and, you know, I mean, that's a lot of that informed him. And then he also saw what happened afterwards. You know, the 50s was another great time of this hopefulness of what machines could do. You know, we're getting ready to go to the moon and all of this.
Exactly. And you talk about Metropolis. The great German director Fritz Lang was a friend of Ray Bradbury's. Oh, he came over to see Ray Bradbury because he loved the way that Ray Bradbury painted the complexities of dark and light in our culture. So, sure. And what you're leading up to, Christy, with that, the beginning of your comment, is that Ray grows up in that real transitional interwar time through World War II. But World War II throws us on the world stage as the preeminent power for so long. And by the 50s, which I remember, I'm almost 70. So for me, you know, the 50s was this wonderful place where Americans could always solve the problem. It's like It's like the survivor from The Martian says at the end, you solve one problem, you solve the next problem, you can do it. You could just science the hell out of everything and you can solve it. And a lot of the early science fiction movies touched on that. And Ray wrote one of them. He wrote the very first one that shows the scientists solving problems about mysteries from outer space. It's called It Came from Outer Space. And he was always worried about, would creatures from a completely different environment be so different from us, we could never understand them, and they could never understand us. But back, I want just for a second, get back to what Tricia said. You know, what that, your example of the youngster is very good, because he's actually looking at the profound question. He's not just saying, geez, just write a check, Mom, right? Just write a check and I can have whatever it is I want. It's not that simple. This child you're talking about wants to have the vision and the great good fortune to solve things with machines, things we need done. And, you know, it's even harder today to face the things we need done. In the 50s, you know, my memories of the 50s and in the early 60s was, wow, we can solve anything. But of course, at the same time, we were blind to many of the problems that there were and the inequalities that there were. Ray Bradbury wasn't blind to those things. He wrote stories about people and he just put them in outer space. And he wrote stories about the heartbreak of having to face intolerance. So this is a guy who's a dreamer. We see a lot of dreams here, right? Right through to Green Wine for Dreaming. And yet he's also a person who never loses touch of the human heart. He wrote in a 1952 introduction to a story collection he edited for other people. He said, you know, scientists understand the technical qualities of the heart, the musculature, the cardiopulmonary characteristics of the heart. But we writers know the heart and understand the heart better than they do. He always felt that. He wasn't technical. He didn't want to predict futures. He just wanted to prevent some futures. And that's why you have Fahrenheit 451, see. But with Dandelion Wine, you know, he wrote a play version of it in the 60s where he goes back and visits, and he's in his 40s, and he goes back and visits Douglas this summer because he's lost the joy of life and the insights he received when he was that little boy. And in the play, Bradbury has him go back and meet the little boy again and try and remember what he learned that summer of 1928. And you know, you can see that it never leaves Bradbury's life. He was still in love with this story till the day he died in 2012.
Robin, did you have a comment?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, and this is maybe a little more general, just thinking about machines and especially the role they play in Dandelion Wine. I wonder now if, I always wonder if Ray Bradbury could have existed in 2020 and he could have written the stories that he wrote, because machines were almost magical. As the technological age came about, we had this mysticism and we have all these writers writing science, and you have L. Ron Hubbard and, you know, Ray Bradbury and all these phenomenal minds. I almost feel like we become desensitized now to technology in a way that we couldn't visualize the romance of our relationship with technology like Bradbury did. And I think that's sad in a way. I'd like to see more stories come out. Maybe I'm just missing them. Maybe there are some phenomenal science fiction writers right now who are producing stories. But I wonder if we've moved past an era where we'll still sense the magic of some of these concepts. It's just what I was thinking. No, no, no.
I would love to hear
Ray Bradbury reader there. Go ahead, Tricia. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I love the question, if we can pull out that thread among others of if anybody in the chat or wants to jump in with like modern contemporary writers who they feel like have a little bit of that magic. Mm-hmm. In how they talk about the future and technology and all that, because it'd be a fun next read if anybody has somebody who they feel like is just particularly inspired by that idea, that magic of the future and technology, but with that Bradbury darkness swirled in.
Well, you know, if any of you read Mary Robinette Kowal, she just won the Hugo for one of her astronaut novels. It's alternate reality where women get into the space program early on in the 1950s and become some of the first astronauts to go to the moon and to go to Mars. And it's done with tremendous technical skill because she really did her homework on it. N.K. Jemisin is another one who writes with great emotional power, but I don't know if she has that much technology in her work. Ray would have trouble today because he's not numerate. He wasn't scientific, but he would see the same problems, which I think, Robin, you were alluding to. He would understand the challenges facing us right now, and he would still be writing from his heart, wouldn't he?
That does, I'd love to hear if other people have thoughts about other writers who are doing this today, but it does make me wonder, did he consider himself a science fiction writer?
Well, he was never really upset about being called a science fiction writer, when you really came right down to it, because he was most proud of four things. He was most proud of having stood up for freedom of the imagination at a time when that was under threat in this country, for standing up for literacy, for the preservation of libraries, and for the space age, and for continuing the space program so that we can have immortality someday out in the stars. So he didn't mind having that crown, but he considered that really to be mainstream literature. He was at a conference with Aldous Huxley right before Huxley died in the early 60s, and Huxley was lamenting the fact that mainstream literature was dying. And Bradbury says, science fiction is the mainstream literature now. It's not dying, okay? So, I'm not sure. I didn't want to interrupt this thread, though. Other writers you all could think of. Ray didn't like labels per se generally, but he was okay with science fiction. Who do you read? Who do you all read now? I have trouble. I'm doing so many books all the time and working on his centennial projects. I don't get to read much. What do you all read?
I don't read a lot of sci-fi. I'm 30 pages from the end of The Mirror of the Light, the Hilary Mantel novel. That is not
You like it? You like it?
It was an incredible read.
Good.
Cromwell's about to get it. I knew it was coming. I've known it was coming for three books, but here we are. It's a heartbreaker. So if anybody's reading it, stick with it. It's long. It's 800 pages.
I would also say that N.K. Jemisin's books are fantastic, and it's a really, really great world building that she mm-hmm. does in her books. There's also a writer named G. Willow Wilson mm-hmm. who's written memoirs and other books, but she has a new graphic novel where she's kind of created an entire universe that's just a lot of fun to spend time into. She also has written for Ms. Marvel comics and others, but she's kind of created her first complete world as a new graphic novel after, you know, writing in a bunch of different genres. She's taken on that one, and it's interesting to see somebody who I don't think, you know, came up at thinking of themselves as somebody who writes in that space take on those genres for the first time. So I think there's some interesting work being done there in the graphic novel world, where there's actually a lot of really interesting world building and stories being done.
Well, you know, I'd love to see what really is out there in the graphic novel world these days, because I'm by the nature of my job, I have to stay focused on the mid-century graphic artists who love doing Ray Bradbury stories because they're so visual. And you have all the old EC artists from EC Comics and other graphic arts people, even mainstream artists like the Saturday Evening Post. Here's another. This was, you know, the story about the sneakers, the tennis shoes, right? Early on in a book. Okay, when it was published in the Saturday Evening Post, this is a beautiful art that was done for it, with the boy running through the creek and everything, getting ready to go buy his new tennis shoes. So all of those people and many generations of writers, illustrators, have illustrated Bradbury. He's had graphic novels made out of Fahrenheit, The Martian Chronicles, Something Wicked This Way Comes. But I'd like to see what's being done with new and original graphic stories today. And when I'm finally done with the centennial and actually, I'm going to have to retire here pretty soon. This is the kind of thing I'd like to look forward to read. So recommend them to me.
Yeah, if people have recommendations, throw them in the Slack, in the chat channel, because people are always looking for good recommendations. One, we had, Sarah, I think I see you on here. You had posted in the group a couple of days ago that you'd always considered Bradbury, or thought of Bradbury as a dystopian sci-fi writer, and hadn't loved Fahrenheit. And reading Dandelion Wine, felt that, you know, you discovered an entirely new author. Is that true to some degree with each of his books that people read? Are they so disparate? And Sarah, do you have any other comments about that? I mean, did you feel like you found somebody entirely new with this?
I did. I didn't enjoy Bradbury in the past, and I loved Dandelion Wine, and I'm looking forward to reading his other books.
Well, there are dark stories in the Martian Chronicles and in the Illustrated Man, and Dandelion Wine is a different thing, but remember that he starts Dandelion Wine, kind of that impulse to write about the Midwest and the discovery of who he was before he even writes most of that good science fiction stuff. So that's deeply buried in him. And when it comes out in the mid-50s, it was very different kind of book for him. And his editors had hoped that would move him out into the literary mainstream. And it remains probably one of the four biggest selling books that he has. It was always, for many years, The Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man, and Dandelion Wine. And then in the last 30 years, Fahrenheit 451 has climbed above them all, because we're worried about, we're still worried about the death of the imagination, or the suppression of the imagination, or being distracted from any kind of literary writing that makes you think by the technology that gives us pleasure, okay? And he had to come to terms with that himself, with allowing finally his books to be in ebooks. He didn't trust it. It didn't smell like a book. It didn't feel like a book. It didn't make noises like a book. You couldn't riffle the pages on it. But finally, he realized that more people can read for less money and have more access to literature through ebooks. So he started opening up all his books to being online. He firmly believed that public libraries like the Carnegie were the greatest things that happened in America, because those libraries that Carnegie provided money for would only be built as long as the books would be free to everybody, and everybody could come to the libraries. So that meant so much to him. And Dandelion Wine shows you some of that too. Going to the library allowed him to imagine all the things that you see taken from his real life and projected on out into fantasy. At the same time, Dandelion Wine was a different kind of book, and a lot of people felt Bradbury lost his edge after that, that he couldn't really write those dark stories anymore. But you know what? I don't think that's a bad thing. Writers change, right? They change over 70 years. He wrote for 70 years. I think we got other people that are writing. What do you have there?
Yeah, if I could ask a question about that. It does seem to me, and it always has, that Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 is a kind of an exception to his novels. It seems like it's more similar to his short stories, which did always seem to me very kind of dark, dystopian, a word we used earlier. But then also his other novels, following Dandelion Wine, like Something Wicked, The Halloween Tree, these have there's some darkness there, but they also feel sweet in the same sort of way that Dandelion feels sweet. So I wonder if that is a chronological distinction as much as it is a genre distinction?
Well, yes. People will say, in the book I just published, Bradbury Beyond Apollo, I have to cover the last 40 years of his life where he's becoming so famous and influential, but he's not writing good stuff anymore, you know? And the reviews so far are, wow, this is a great conclusion to his life, but a lot of the reviews are also, geez, was this even worth writing? Because he's different. And what would happen is, what you're saying, Matt, is you're describing to me that delicate balance he has to maintain really from Dandelion Wine on through his career, of having nostalgia that means something, without falling completely over into sentimentality, okay? Mm-hmm. And he isn't always able to maintain that from there on out as he ages on through his career.
You know, when I was 10 or 11, The Halloween Tree was my favorite Ray Bradbury. As I aged, you know, then it kind of faded. And I think I like The Martian Chronicles much better now. But I wonder, you know, there is that kind of youthfulness. I suppose it might speak to young people in some of those later things, as opposed to his short stories.
Yeah, the works that he wove together into like a novelized story cycle, like The Martian Chronicles and Dandelion Wine, and Halloween Tree too, he had to build that. That's built out of a painting. In 1960, he painted a tree with lit jack-o'-lanterns growing off the tree, and underneath the tree, the leaves had formed the pattern of a body decaying into the dust. And that was a root metaphor for life and death, of course. And the entire cycles of renewal that we celebrate in all kinds of rituals down through time that Halloween is a part of. And so all of these had to be pieced together for him. Very rarely was he ever able to write a novel out of whole cloth. Something Wicked, he was able to write that as a novel, but even that started as one single short story.
We're getting near the end, so if anybody has any other questions or comments they want to raise about Dandelion Wine, or any questions about Bradbury they would like to offer up to Dr. Eller, now's your chance. Please do it.
And Trish has put some nice things for us, for everyone, for reading, right?
Yeah.
The Willow Wilson graphic novel, and then some other little links there for us. Good.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so that's I couldn't think of the name of it, so I had to Google it. It's called Invisible Kingdom, and I just threw the description in there for folks. I think it came out in 2019, that volume one, and the second installment in that series, I believe, has just come out very recently. So, but yeah, it's an interesting sort of take on a sci-fi story.
Well, this is good. I mean, you know, when we come and we contribute in book club discussions, we come away learning things too about our guy and about kindred spirits writing today. And that's exactly what you've shown me.
Sarah?
I had a question. When Douglas gets sick near the end of the book, that kind of struck me as out of tune with the rest of the book. I didn't feel like it fell in flow-wise. I don't know if I'm missing something or if that was a story from Bradbury specifically that happened to him that he threw in. That was just a question that I had as I was reading it.
Well, you're a good reader, because that is a problematic story for him. There, this is one of the three or four stories that he couldn't get published. He always had trouble ending things. Problem for Bradbury is, he made this deal with his subconscious. He wouldn't let his rational, self-conscious mind take over a story until his subconscious had let him just simply type it out on his typewriter in just a few hours. And the problem was, he never knew where the stories were going. And even when he pulls this book together, Dandelion Wine, he doesn't know how to end it. And so he's trying to give something, add one more thing from his childhood memories. Basically, he's got what sure sounds like the influenza of that time and of our time. And he's almost dying, you know? And he's really dying because his heart is sick. He's sad because he's losing things. What does Mr. Jonas say to him there, bending over his cot out there in the yard? He says, "Some people turn sad awfully young. No special reason, it seems, but they seem almost to be born that way. They bruise easier, tire faster, cry quicker, remember longer, and as I say, get sadder younger than anyone else in the world. I know, for I'm one of them." He's a doctor who knows what his medicine is for. And by putting those bottles of refreshment there with Douglas out there in the cot and just leaving him alone, he's going to help Douglas go through that psychoanalytical process of realizing that something bad has happened, but we can get through it. And he recovers. And that was Ray's sort of between the lines way of having all of the disappointments of the summer not stay there forever, but be remediable. And that's why that story is there. It was a tough way for him to get out of it. And then, hey, how else are you going to end a book like this? If nothing else, Green Wine for Dreaming, Mr. Jonas's story, sets us up for the magical kitchen, Grandma's kitchen, right? Isn't that the last true story in the whole book, right? Grandma is so scientific suddenly about her cooking because of Aunt Rose that the food's awful. And Grandma was always such a wonderful cook. And then Douglas pays it forward from what he's learned from Mr. Jonas, the secrets he's got from Mr. Jonas. He takes care of everything. He goes down there in the night and he gets rid of those other cookbooks, right? And Grandma's back to her normal self. So I guess, that's what, Sarah, your question prompted me to just think real quickly. How does all that end in Dandelion Wine? How does he pull it together? Anyway, that's my spin on it.
And I'm sure everybody has a different take slightly. I saw it, you know, as this young boy who has this terrible realization that he can die. And then he finds himself in a, whether that brought on this fever, then he finds himself actually in the position where that may actually come to pass.
Well, you know, this is a book that you come to, I think, appreciate more with age. I mean, I look back and think of, you know, the air raid drills and the air raid shelters, that was just part of life when we were in elementary school and junior high school and high school, you know. The nuclear above ground testings were so prolific in the 50s that my younger sister's generation, they all have strontium 90 in their bones because it was in the atmosphere and it was absorbed then for young babies to have. I don't, I'm old enough that I don't. But it was a time when it was easy to be depressed as a kid, to go out and play like Ray Bradbury's playing here. And then when you're just having the most fun, say, oh yeah, well, the Russians could blow us up tomorrow. And you expected it to happen. And this book is sort of an antidote for that because he's writing it during that very time.
It's interesting to think too, right, about kids who are that age this summer. And there's a threat outside that they're constantly aware of, that their parents are talking about all the time, that they're being told to be afraid of in the coronavirus, among other things that are ailing our society, this sort of big bad that's unseeable and sort of they're just old enough maybe to understand they need to wash their hands and they need to stay away from people and all of this. But the idea that, you know, there's this looming threat feels, it's different, right? It's not exactly the same, but to a kid, that looming cloud is sort of over this summer for a lot of kids right now too.
It sure is. And get them reading a little bit, have them read some of Bradbury's short stories or some of these stories. And at Halloween, let them read The Halloween Tree, because that's a story about self-sacrifice to renew somebody's life. It's really a neat little book. So I commend all that to you tonight. This has been great. I've enjoyed it. Christy, thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. I mean, you know, the fact that you know his body of work, you knew him. I mean, it's incredible how much you know about his work. It's really remarkable. So thank you so much. If anybody has any other comments or questions, now's your moment. Otherwise, we'll wrap up.
And you can always get to me through Christy if you have any follow-up, or come visit us at the center. Take our virtual tour on our website if you want to see all these wonderful things. We rebuilt his whole office here.
Oh, that's cool. One other thing I should note, and I'll put this in the Facebook group tonight. Dr. Eller sent me over a list of his favorite Bradbury books, so I'll share that with everyone as well. All right. Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Dr. Eller.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Jonathan Eller. He's director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. Joining him was Radio West executive producer Christy Miners. This was our Radio West Book Club meeting for June, where we talked about Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine. Now, if you're interested in becoming a member of the book club, go to our website, radiowest.org, for more information. And we'd love to have you join us for July. We're going to be reading Go Tell It on the Mountain by James